Hello, I am Brad Henderson. I am here with Randall Bodnat, who directed, wrote and directed Surf 2. And we're going to be doing the commentary on this track is Randall's original vision. How are you doing?
I'm good, Brad. Thank you.
So, of course, right out of the gate, this film opens differently. And I would like to hear about that. With of course this opening with of course the stock footage rather than kind of the white on black titles that we have in the original or the theatrical.
Right. Yeah, well the two versions are, pretty dramatically different. I mean, we did this one, there's sort of a long story behind the transition from this one to the other. But this one was done kind of fall of 83, because I think we shot the film in the summer of 83. And I did this edit with Jackie Cambus, and this really was the film that we made. The intention was to put this version out. At the time, I was a pocket client of one of the major CAA agents, and by pocket client, I mean, you have one guy ignoring you as opposed to the entire agency. But he was going to sell. He was convinced that he could lay this off at one of the major studios, and so we had one answer print cut directly from the negative, which we all assumed disappeared after the recut. And somehow, miraculously, this is it. And the idea here was, just to a kind of fun, goofy, good-natured opening to a really stupid, fun, goofy, good-natured movie. And so that's what we're seeing. I think, in short, you could probably sum it up by saying there's less boobs, more Eddie. Although that's not doing justice to like Tom Villard, that whole section of Tom Villard doing Johnny Ray's cry, I think most of that got cut. There's a lot of stuff that got cut. And what really strikes me more than anything, and looking at the two of them, and by the way, this first, you guys sent me a copy of this, a month ago, but really, it's the first time I'm seeing this since 1983 because I thought it was destroyed and, there was no, they recut the negative when they did the second version. And so the fact that we have this is somewhat of a miracle.
But we're definitely happy to have this and with a big thing is just, like I said, right out of the gate, our opening is different because, the theatrical has the scrawl that pops up, then it has the nighttime shot with, the scuba divers, and then, of course, you have, with your version, with your original vision, is that there's a lot more comedy that is put in throughout the film. And that's a big thing too. I mean, even when the marching band was walking over the guy, in your vision or version, there's they kind of crush him a little bit, and there's just there's little differences throughout, which you can get into this, of course, but it's just yours is definitely more charming.
Well, thanks.
And
plus, less rude.
Right. And there's also the opening with the Beach Boys song with the stock footage. It just kind of gets you in the mood for the film that you're going to watch.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, the idea, really we knew we were going to get an R based on the language. And there are a couple of, brief boob shots, but it was never meant to be salacious or raunchy in the way that the theatrical version came out. So what I started to allude to was that CAA was guaranteed us that they were going to, well, guaranteed the money guys, that they were going to lay this off at one of the studios and everybody would, make their money and be happy and the film would be distributed and that was that. So the last time I actually saw this was at one of, it was either Universal or at Warner's, and I can't remember which, and they set up a screening for the suits and for a test audience of kids. And the kids loved it, and the suits hated it. And that was the end of that. And when it didn't sell at one of the majors, which for an independent film in this era was almost unheard of. I mean, not unheard of that it didn't sell. Had it been picked up, that would have been unheard of. These, you know, low-budget independent films never got major theatrical distribution. But the guys at CAA had so convinced the money guys that this was a slam dunk that when it didn't sell, they thought something was wrong. And rather than making some kind of a typical distribution agreement for this type of film, they decided, well, it just needed, you know, based on the success of Porky's, that this needed lots more skin and lots more raunch. And rather than, you know, try and make a respectable distribution deal that wouldn't have made anybody rich, but would have gotten the film out there and, you know, presumably would have found an audience, they insisted on this recut, which is how the theatrical version came to be.
Yeah, and, you know, you can also tell any time a movie is toyed with, you know, it really... Because even if you add shots, and which they did, you know, obviously we just came off the, you know, the boys getting in their car and driving, and then they come across that car that has the four girls in it to take off their tops, right, and show their butts. That's not in your version at all.
Right. But that was all second unit.
Yeah, and when stuff is done like that, I mean, you know, you're a filmmaker, it really throws off the vibe for this film, and it's jarring when you have scenes like that are placed that don't feel. Even though we have, you know, myself, I've grown up with a theatrical version, and yes, I do like it. But you know, even for me, seeing your version, it is a completely different movie. It is more fun, you know, and then that's the thing. Yeah. It's almost like this big surprise that you know, for fans of this theatrical version know and love, they're gonna be just knocked on their asses with this, just because I think it's just so much better. But again, we have both versions that are included, so that's perfect for whatever you know, people want to see.
Yeah, no, I mean, like I said, it's a miracle that we have this, and I'm really happy that we do, because, you know, I've kind of, and I know I discussed this with Zach in a previous commentary, but I was a little embarrassed by some of the stuff that went into. And unfortunately, you know, I sort of stayed with it. I was participant to the cut, which was really a kind of a butcher job. But I wanted to protect the film. And, you know, in seeing them both side to side or back to back now, you can see how dramatically different they are and how much of a, you know, just the overall tone and the overall, you know, takeaway that you get, the experience of the film is really different. And when you think about it, the running time on this one is at least 10 minutes longer. And I think you have the exact
There is 10 minutes longer, but you also have to keep in mind that there's little scenes throughout your version that were cut, reaction shots. So it's 10 minutes, but it's actually a lot more footage.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so I don't know the exact amount of time, but I wouldn't be afraid to say it's at least 15.
That's what I guess.
15 minutes of additional footage. And then also you have to take away everything, and just even with that montage that we just saw with the surfers in the water. In the theatrical version, there's that cut that just keeps going back to the woman that has the water falling on her body in her bikini, you know.
Right.
There's various sequences that are just missing. But, you know, again, you know, even this going through this dark tunnel, I believe that they end up at the arcade after the surfing kind of a montage. They end up at the arcade, and then we get into this. So yeah, honestly, it's not just 10 minutes. It's drastically different.
It is drastically different. Yeah. And you know what's, I just had a thought, but I think I lost it. I know what I was going to say, that there was this somehow this misapprehension. Is that the right word? I'm not sure. But when Walt and the money guys began the recut, there was this kind of concern that people couldn't follow the story, which utterly mystified me, and that accounts for some of the restructuring and moving some of the pieces around and a lot of the cutting, and for instance the twirling newspaper article at the when you get to the town council meeting, stuff like that. And there isn't that much story to begin with, so for the idea that this thing could have been confusing, there just isn't that much to follow, and there really isn't that much complication to it. So I think everybody was just bamboozled and overreacted to the fact that a studio didn't pick it up, and then there was this just rush to kind of reconfigure the movie, try and turn it into something that it wasn't. So that accounts for a lot of that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you have I guess a big question that I have for you, and then we can obviously start dissecting this a little bit more, but you made your career in film and you've done a lot, but being that this was kind of taken away from you, did this kind of really make you think about, did you ever want to direct again because of what happened?
It just made me really depressed.
Yeah.
I think more than anything, it just was so, so sad to see this, it's something that you put so much work into, and we were never, it wasn't like a labor of, we weren't trying to create something, a work of genius or a work of art. Because, and I've talked about this, in previous discussions,
right.
It was a goof from the get-go, and we always treated it that way, but we did our best. I mean, we absolutely tried to make the best movie we could make, given the amount of money we had, the subject matter, which, it makes very little sense to begin with, but it's somewhat cohesive. And, To just watch it turned into something. I mean, there are a couple of things in the theatrical version that I liked. Very few, however. The bird shit in the sandwiches at the Gross Al contest is funny, except the way it's done, and because they wanted to get in as much TNA as they possibly could, so there all of this stuff which doesn't match, which just feels out of sync with the overall tone of the movie, is kind of jammed in there. But the birds crapping in these guys' sandwiches is funny, and I'm sure there are plenty of people who are familiar with the movie who will miss that. The other thing that I really miss in this is at the end where the two large boys, Fred and Jim, chase the two dads. I thought that was very funny, and I thought it was a great way to go out. Other than that, and a couple of the sound effects, everything else that was done to it was horrible. And like I said, Ron and George wouldn't participate, and I couldn't blame them, but I had to stick with it just to try and protect what was there, and I didn't really do all that good a job, because when you really, in the end, the product is considerably different, and for my money, just diminished.
Yeah, No, it's yeah, I completely understand. Here we're watching. This is the actual opening of the
Right.
film that we're seeing now, and then of course the moment where they're in the basement that comes after the arcade sequence.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean it's you know there are these like. You know, I wouldn't say that's subtle because that's a whole rearranging of scenes. But yeah, no, I was just curious of like, you know, obviously, you know, you made your living as a writer, a good writer. And, you know, so I was just kind of curious if this just completely left a bad taste in your mouth. But did I guess my next question for you is that did it help through the years of this becoming kind of a thing, you know, this is a, you know, midnight screenings and kind of the love from all these people and people writing about it, showing up at midnight to rewatch it. Did that help at all with your feelings toward this theatrical cut?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you asked that, but let me just point out that this, when Walt suggested that we use this as the opening, because it's duplicated. So what we did was we flipped the footage and then we blurred the faces, like nobody would notice that this is the same scene. So, you know, it was kind of preposterous to, and this was all predicated on the notion that people were having trouble following the story. But to answer your question, I was completely unaware that this film had caught on. From my point of view, I just assumed, you know, Surf 2 was something I did. I was a little embarrassed by the theatrical release, which was yanked because everybody started suing everybody else because they weren't content just to, you know, take a standard distribution deal. And then it disappeared. So I really had no idea that this thing had gained a following. And on the 25th anniversary, when I was driving around with my kids, got a phone call at like 4 p.m. from George wondering if I was going to be at the screening that night. So I'm in Santa Barbara driving around with my kids. I have no idea what he's talking about. And he tells me it's the 25th anniversary and, you know, Draft House has put together this 25th anniversary screening at the New Beverly Cinema and, you know, I had to be there. And my response was, why? You know, nobody's going to be there. This is going to be just us. And, you know, George, so I hadn't even heard about it. Nobody, I guess maybe George was supposed to call me and he forgot. I have no idea. But at any rate, I went and there it was packed. There were lines around the block, people wanting autographs, and you know. So to answer your question, no, it really, I had no idea, and so I just assumed that, you know, it was just an experience that you just kind of write off.
Now let's talk a little bit about this with this ensemble cast that we have in front of us with Ruth Buzzy and just, you know, just an amazing, amazing array of characters in this film to begin with, but alone just the actors that you have. I know, of course, Fern Champion was casting, but obviously you had your hands in this too. Can you talk a little bit about working with these comedy geniuses, really?
Yeah, well, we were really lucky. And, you know, Fern and Pamela brought in a host of extraordinarily talented people. And, you know, the idea that we could get Ruth Buzzy and Lyle Wagner and Terry Kaiser and, you know, and really the list goes on and on. I was completely shocked when, you know, not only when they walked through the door, but they wanted to do it. So, you know, we just got really lucky. There was something that appealed to them about it. I know, and I've said this before, you know, Ruth told me, both Ruth and Brandis told me they just loved doing it because they never got to curse on camera before. And you know, essentially everybody just got into the spirit of, wow, we can we can pretty much, you know, we're all in on the same joke. You know, this is just a fun, kind of wacky, one-of-a-kind thing, and somehow it's getting made, and let's just have a good time doing it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I spoke to Terry Kaiser when we were doing all this. Unfortunately, he passed on the interview, but he had nothing but just the nicest and most amazing things. That we talked for about 15 minutes about how much he loved doing this movie, just because he got to do something that, you know, of course he's in comedies all through his life, but you know, he really had a great time just on set. And then honestly, that's the general consensus from everybody. Yeah. You know, we release a lot of films at Vinegar Syndrome, and it's rare to have something where everybody is just, you know, kind of over the moon with such a silly movie too. I mean, I love this movie near to my heart, but it is goofy, it is silly, it's zany, but it's a good time, you know, and if people are having a good time on set, you know, that's a good thing. So yeah. It's just, you know, having this ensemble, and then also just all these kids that are just having fun. I mean, no one's really done anything big yet. You know, with Eric Stoltz, this is one of his, you know, probably his, like, what?
Well,
second
he came,
or third film?
This was after Fast Times. And, yeah. You know, interestingly, Eric came in, and the minute Eric walked through the door, it was just, boom, you're hired. You know,
yeah,
there was no question. But he had, you know, he had done Fast Times with Sean Penn, and Sean Penn really got into this. You know, his Spicoli character is legendary, and he used to go and hang around at Malibu and observe and, you know, and listen to the surfers. And what he noticed was that they all seemed to have like clogged up sinuses. And so both he and Eric, well, Sean figured it out, and he stuffed his nose with plugs of cotton up in his nose so that he would have this kind of nasal surfery twang. So Eric came in, you know, he got into it, and, you know, he showed up and he just had it down. Yeah.
And of course, Jeffrey Rogers here, who eventually became a doctor.
Did he really? You
know, yeah, he became a doctor. Yeah, I found him too, but he's got a very serious, you know, career now. But yeah, he's a doctor.
I had no idea. He was a great guy and just game for anything. And you know, Jeffrey was. Super enthusiastic, really just, you know, so easy to work with. And I didn't really have any problems with anyone. We, you know, everybody was just into it. And, aside from Ron Palillo wanting more lines, it was a good time.
Now, with the whole thing of casting, who... I guess with it's Fred Asparagus and Jim Greenleaf. When did they come in? Because they have a very, even though they're not on screen very much, is what we just saw where they get dragged away now. They don't have a lot of screen time, but the chemistry, between them is very, very good. Where did they come in, and did they know each other prior?
I don't think they did, aside from maybe once being in the same salad. I mean, it's funny that the two large boys are, you know, both vegetable names. No, it was just good chemistry. You know, they got into it. I mean, when Josh Cadman showed up, you know, to audition for Big Head, when he showed up with a six-pack of beer and proceeded to drink the whole thing, you know, just guzzled can after can. I had to pry one away from him in the casting session just to, you know, get into the spirit of things. But I think without exception, everyone just, you know, kind of loved their part, loved having the chance to do something so ridiculous and get paid for it.
And you know, with Linda Carriage, because I'm you know, pals with Linda, and I've talked to her numerous times. Because I know originally that there were others that didn't really want her in the film. I just was curious if you ever heard that story. One, that they tried to recast her, and two, no. who stuck up for her and really wanted her in the film.
No, that's news to me. That I didn't know. And I know that she had worked with George. She was in Fade to Black, wasn't she?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, which we released not too long ago.
Yeah. I really don't know. Maybe I've forgotten. It's very possible. It's been a long time. The only thing I can tell you about, you know, Linda's part is that the original script didn't have Linda's part in it. And so when Lou George, the foreign sales money guy, got involved, and he was first one in, he basically said, you know, I need a girl on a surfboard, a poster with a girl on a surfboard to take for MeFed, and I can, you know, raise the money to make this film. So that was the origin of Linda's character. The original script was just a bunch of deadhead surfers and, you know, and their parents and Eddie. What do you mean why? You were
there. I know. Gotcha.
How is Linda, by the way?
She's great. She's just living it up in the mountains in Australia. Just kind of cut off from, you know, everybody. You know, she had a kid after she was in, you know, some, you know, quite a few movies in the 80s, late 80s. And she had a child and just went back to Australia, raised her kid, lived up in the mountains, and she's living a great life.
Well, that's nice.
But she's completely cut off from society. it was really, really hard to get a hold of her and find her. But you know, I just told her, you know, you have fans, you know, and people love you, and I love you. I think you're great. You know, she's such a has just this really great on screen presence in her films, and always turns heads. And you know, she was kind of unaware of kind of her popularity, you know, coming back, aside from Fade to Black, because everybody, like, that's what they remember her most by. But yeah, she's a wonderful, wonderful person.
That's great to hear.
Yeah.
Well, she was great to work with. I mean, you know, Linda was a dream. I mean, you know, to find the girl who could play both, you know, Florinda Budnick and Sparkle.
Right, yeah, absolutely.
You know, and was willing to do it. So she was great. Now, it's funny, you know, you asked about casting, because there were a few people who came in, and not more than a few, who literally looked at us like we were insane. I mean, I had guys, you know, pick up the script and start to read and go and said, "Are you kidding?" and walked out. You know, I went to Yale drama. I'm not doing this. So, but everybody who, you know, signed up definitely did their part.
Now, with the script, I know we talked a little bit about this in the interview and whatnot. You know, writing something this crazy, how much was it from the script to the shooting script to what we actually see? How much did these characters get into it and have kind of room for improv? Like, what did you, how did you direct that? And just kind of tell us the evolution of the script to screen.
Well, so the biggest change in the script was Linda's character. Other than that, you know, we had to lop stuff out that just we couldn't afford to do. We kept a lot of the gags. I know I told Zach in the interview that we did here that the original script opened with a scene at the beach and a broken surfboard washing to the shore. This is at a remote beach, and It's a little a family having a picnic, and the kids run and pull the surfboard out of the surf. The broken piece and attached to it is a leash, and on the end of the leash is a stump of a leg, and a bloody stump. And as they're screaming, the leg starts jumping across the sand. Well, of course, we couldn't afford to do that. But aside from stuff like that, the script remained pretty much as written, with the inclusion of Linda. But there really was no mandate. I didn't have anybody. I mean, Ron and George were great. They were into it from the get-go, and it wasn't like I had to change things to conform to anybody's limitations or preconceptions or their idea of what this film should be. I think it was pretty clear from the get-go that that this was just a piece of lunacy that somehow wound up on paper. So yeah, so it was pretty much as written.
This even going back to the kind of the characters and everybody, everybody that is in this movie soaks up their screen time. There's nothing wasted.
Yeah. You would ask me about improvisation. I gave everybody and sorry to interrupt there.
Oh no, go ahead,
Brad. So, everyone had a pretty loose leash. If they had an idea, I was open to exploring it. Guys like Biff, he was hysterical. I mean, Biff had some hysterical lines, and of course, I wasn't going to stifle that. And Tom Villard, I mentioned his rendition of Cry, which he does at the beach party, and that was his idea. As if I remember correctly, he came to me and he said, "Listen, I do this great sort of lip sync to Johnny Ray," and so we got we got the rights and let him go for it. And unfortunately, in the theatrical version, most of that got cut out. But in this version, he gets to do his whole thing, and he's amazing. It's like really kind of a memorable performance.
Yeah, no, Tom Villard is, it's really, really, really a shame that he died so, so young, too, years ago, like the...
Oh, my God, sure. Yeah, this was, this was almost like a death sentence doing this movie. So many of the cast are gone, but a lot of them, like Carol Wayne and Tom Villard, passed away, really soon after this thing was done. And Tom was so young and a really, really talented guy. That was just, tragic.
Yeah, and he's every time he's on screen, he doesn't miss. He's always
no, he doesn't.
He's known for his small roles too. He doesn't have really anything big, but when he's on screen, he has such a presence. It was just really great.
Yeah, now I got kind of close with Tom. I mean, he would just, he just loved, playing Jocko, and he stayed in touch, and he was just a really lovely guy. Yeah.
And then with Peter Isaacson, with him and being involved, I heard stories about him kind of being like a mentor to some of the kids.
Yeah.
What can you talk a little bit about that? Of like, did he kind of take charge with the younger crowd? Like, how did that? How did he get involved?
Peter's just a wonderful, wonderfully affable, comforting kind of presence, and so he established himself as You know, at the craft service table. I mean, you know, at lunchtime, it was Peter, just, you know, it was the Peter Isaacson show. He's a very funny guy. You know, he had done CPO Sharky. He was, you know, no stranger to being on. He certainly was not. It was a very rare combination of someone who was, you know, comfortable being on and entertaining, but never kind of held forth. It just, he did it as just by being him. And we got to be great friends and have stayed friends. I talked to Peter just before he did his interview, and he wrote to me. He said, "Listen, I'm doing this interview. Why don't you call in the middle of the interview and give me direction?" And I thought, I declined to do that. I just said, "Peter, just be the star you were born to be." And I think that's pretty much, you know, he just is who he is. He's just a lovely guy, and very successful. You know, I mean, Peter's doing big shoots. He did an archaeological dig in Egypt for National Geographic. He was told me that they were going to do something else. And by the way, I'm looking at, you know, this surf sequence. This totally got lopped out. If you notice at the beginning of this sequence, you see a, you know, broken piece of surfboard. That's a relic from the first scene of the movie. And in fact, this whole sequence is where the movie was supposed to begin. There was going to be the punks attacking a couple of surfers out at a remote beach, and then that piece of surfboard washing on shore. Yeah. And this completely lost, and there's some great surfing in there. There's Jay Riddle and Sean Thompson, and I'm trying to remember who some of the other guys were, but you know,
they Pat really Romano did some of that too.
I don't think Pat did. Pat was a stunt. Pat was a BMX guy, and you know, really a great athlete. But I don't remember Pat doing any of the surfing.
Gotcha. Yeah, he's still very, very active in the stunt world.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah, because that sequence is all missed, because we go directly into this classroom sequence in the theatrical version.
Yeah.
You know.
So I got to ask you, does it make any sense to you? Can you see why anybody thought that the story was hard to follow?
I mean, you know, it's one of those things where when you watch, for me, and I'll be brief, is that I watch movies in the sense of I have my suspension of disbelief, and if I'm starting to watch a movie like Surf 2, I'm not thinking that there's this intricate storyline. I just follow along and play along and have fun, and I don't think it's a confusing movie. I just think it's silly, and I don't know why people would get confused in a movie like this.
Well, no, none of the test audiences did. But like I said, I think it was an overreaction to the unfortunate promise that was made about laying this off at one of the majors.
Yeah. And also having Clavon Little he's just so funny. And he just seems so natural in this that he's having such a good time.
Oh yeah.
Peter was telling me a story about he would drive him pretty much almost every day to the set.
Right, because Clavon didn't drive.
Yeah, and he said he had some of the funniest conversations and just insight and stories. He looked forward to that drive every single day.
Yeah.
So we discussed this somewhat in length on the documentary that we put together. But, you know, I know the title for the film changed, and I believe you said your wife came up with the idea of calling it Surf 2.
Yeah, I believe that. Yeah.
What, was there any pushback for that because of the theatrical response that people would be really confused that there's this sequel that they haven't seen? It, to me, it seems like a bad move, but was it? Like, do you think, I mean, I guess it's kind of hard to tell because you didn't do it the other way, but was there a lot of pushback from calling it a sequel when it really wasn't?
No, because there really wasn't anyone to push back at that point, you know. In those years, they were starting to do things like calling things the title and then the movie, you know. And so this was just an extension of, and I'm trying to think of a couple of examples, but...
Well, there was like Hot Dog the movie and stuff like that that came out. So these kind of zany comedies that existed.
Yeah, so we were just, well, you know, I mean, the original title was Surf Death. And then, you know, which opens with, you know, a bloody stump washing up on shore. And then I went to Surf Trash. And they kept shooting down. It was all really Lou George because Lou needed to sell something at MeFed, and he just knew that there wasn't an appetite for anything that said trash or death or, you know. So we had to come up with something that he could, because that really was what got us started, was Lou taking this to MeFed and getting some contracts and getting us some startup money. So without that, there would be nothing. So the Surf 2 was a way of us amusing ourselves and, you know, satisfying Lou at the same time. So.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And, you know, and that call, it all came out of me hanging around. I mean, I used to surf in Ocean Park with the, you know, the literally punks who surfed. I mean, but these guys with mohawks and, you know, studs and safety pins through their cheeks. And that was the era. And I was just tried to be a fly on the wall. And, you know, while I was waiting for a wave, I'd listen to their stories. And that's kind of where, you know, this all came from.
Yeah, no, the authenticity of kind of the punk rock element of this film is definitely there. Bravo on that, because it really does capture and emulate kind of an attitude, a punk rock attitude. So it really has this punk rock atmosphere and feel, which a lot of films try that and they fail because it doesn't have the attitude that that's supposed to be there. And this one definitely does.
Yeah, well, it's definitely an '80s film. There's no, there's no doubt about it.
So, with a little bit of the locations in this, you know, obviously we're at the theater here and whatnot. Where was mainly most of this movie shot at? Between the beach sequences and inside and exteriors and interiors.
Yeah. We were all around South Bay and the LA Basin. We did all of our, almost all of the beach stuff was done up at Paradise Cove because we were able to control the, you know, we could just rent the beach and control the set. We did a lot of things in and around Hermosa Beach and Manhattan Beach. And I'm trying to remember where the Cove is. It's in one of those little beach towns. Redondo, maybe Manhattan. I think the dad's cola bottling thing, that was all done in an abandoned waste treatment plant in El Segundo. So I don't think some of the surf stuff was done down at Trestles. And those guys, that was all second unit. But I think we stayed within well, probably a 20-mile radius. I think we did the arcade in Redondo, which was about as far south as we went. And
well, I just ask because a lot of the places are public, you know, a lot of public places. So that was, I guess, my question is, you know, dealing with that. There's not a lot of sets in this movie.
Right.
So I was just kind of curious of being a first-time filmmaker, you know, a director, really, kind of how that experience was. Because I know that you said that definitely Scott Easton helped quite a bit in that sense. But, you know, it's bravo to both of you. But I was just kind of curious of kind of setting that up, getting to that point, kind of how you organized that and had help organizing all of that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you just, it's catch as catch can. I mean, I thought Scotty did a great job of nailing down our locations and, you know, making everything work. I mean, he was a pro. He certainly couldn't have done it without him or somebody who had his level of expertise. But, you know, for the most part, they created an environment that we could all work within. I don't think we lost any days, you know, because of external circumstances. Everything worked out pretty well. We were lucky.
And I believe also this, this isn't the hat that Eddie wanted. He had, like, the bill that was very long that he brought in that you let him have, right?
Yeah. Oh, that the one that he wears at the end when he's making the sandwiches? Yeah.
I was trying to think of the, you know... But, no, I mean, that's just part of the, you know, kind of the fun attitude is that you have, you know, a film that, you know, actors that are, you know, have that moment that they can kind of do something themselves and bring it in. I mean, it happens all the time, but it just goes in with kind of the attitude to this film.
Well, you know, it's funny. I was thinking about the commentary that I did with Zach on the theatrical version, and I think he asked me about what was it? I can't remember whether it was that hat or something. I don't know. I think I just lost my train of thought there. So
no, it's okay.
I'll circle around. I'm sure it'll come back. Oh no, I know what it was. He asked me about the Jerry Lewis and Eddie, and I think I said something like that the Jerry Lewis reference was in there, and that Eddie sparked to that. And I think I'm completely wrong now that I think, you know, kind of rethink it because it's only been 40 years. But I think Eddie told me that he was, you know, this Jerry Lewis fanatic. And I encouraged him to, you know, dress the set with it. And he brought that picture of Jerry Lewis in and stuck it up on, you know, stuck it up on the Periscope. So you'd actually, you know, probably Eddie would be the one to remember. But I'm pretty sure that was the you know, the way things went, and everybody had the freedom to, you know, bring something of their own, and, you know, either in terms of their performance or you know, how they wanted to dress, or you know, if they had some ad lib ideas, I was always open to it. And for the most part, you know, I think the ad lib lines were always an improvement over what I had.
Yeah. So, yeah, I was going to say, Eddie has this thing where it's Jerry Lewis meets Daffy Duck. That's kind of his thing, and it's really funny. And just another iconic, wonderful actor that always steals, no matter what it is, he steals the scene.
Yeah. Well, you know,
this is a real chainsaw with Josh really cutting this car, by the way, which, you know, you have all these stunt guys, but Josh wanted to do this himself. Can you talk a little bit about you guys really demolishing this car.
Yeah. Well, this was a great gag. And, you know, the prop guys and the effects guys, they cut the roof off of the Caddy and then put it back together with that section in there of fiberglass, so that Josh could cut through the fiberglass with a chainsaw. But yeah. They were able to deliver the gag as written, and I mean, it came out great. It's really one of my favorite gags in the movie.
Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
No. This is always hysterical. They just literally misspelled surfboard. As we showed up on the set, somebody noticed, and so we stuck Terry up on a ladder with a can of paint and had him put the F in.
Yeah, the sequence is great anyway with Ruth and Terry, and it's just kind of going at it.
Oh my God, they just, this was like their favorite scene ever. They just loved going after each other.
Oh, they just feed off one another, and they just chew up the scenery and chew what's up around them, and it's really, really great.
Yeah.
So I was going to ask, where does the, was it just a cool name, but Buzz Cola? Did that have any significance, or was it just, that was the name that you stuck with?
No, I originally wrote it in there, and I think we patented, the reason it has three Z's is that Buzz with two Z's was already taken. But, like I told Zach, that was where I was hoping to make, some big bucks. I thought, if the movie took off, there were no energy drinks at this point. And, Jolt, I think, Coca-Cola came out with Jolt a year after this. But clearly we had an open field. I mean, if this movie had taken off, God only knows what my fortunes would have been like with the, if I could have gotten a bottling deal for Buzz Cola.
Yeah, well, maybe Vinegar Syndrome, we can dip into the drink industry.
Right. Yeah.
No, I just thought it was just a cool name. Generic, but very, it's just one of those things that stick. And yeah. It's appropriate,
Totally. And it says what it is. It was supposed to be just, basically an energy drink, a cola that's just supercharged.
Yeah, Peter Isaacson is just another one that always gets me as well in this.
Peter's hysterical. He was every scene he's in, he just pays it off. I mean, there's really not a dead, moment. Oh, no, here's something that when I watched this, and I hadn't seen this in, almost 40 years. So this was one of the additions in the recut that we actually did a little bit better, and that was having those tracer sounds when O'Finley throws the bottles of Buzz, where they make that whoosh and then explode up in the hills. that's missing, and I think the fart over Josh Cadman's butt. I think that's something that wasn't in the original. But there's, like I said, there are very few things that from the original that I thought were improved in the theatrical version.
Yeah, no, actually that whole sequence is a little choppy between what the theatrical is. There's a lot of little differences here and there with the edit. But, again, we have both of them on here and people can choose. That's the importance of this. And
this was funny. If you watch Tom here, he starts humping Carol. And I mean, we had to he got so into character. I mean, that scene when he literally was just humping her, And then everybody sort of fell down laughing. So we had to cut. But, you know, Tom was like all in. He was, here we lost, you know, most of Dick Dale's performance got lost in the theatrical version. And, I mean, Dick was quite a character. And the whole beach party really got chopped up. The beach party just does not resemble, you know, what it really was.
Yeah, no, I mean, this, because it goes into, basically some second unit stuff that was shot, like close up of, you know, some girls, and then it goes into Dick Dale, it goes into, what's that band's name? The Untouchables.
Right.
So it goes into the Untouchables performance, and,
right.
And then, of course, we have Dick Dale in this one. So, yeah, no, this whole thing is very different. So, like I said, you know, it might be like, I think, 9 or 10 minutes running time, but it is complete. There's so much more that's added and taken away. So eventually somebody, one of our fans, will tell us exactly the amount.
Right.
I just don't think we're going to do that or have done that. But, you know, just watching it and growing up with Surf 2, just watch it. It's very easy to tell on repeated viewings what's different.
Yeah.
And it's just funny to cut Dick Dale and not, it should have been, in a way, it should have been the other way around, cutting out the Untouchables and putting more Dick Dale, because Dick Dale was, you know, the king of surf guitar then. He always has.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You know, just, he was on Ed Sullivan, for Christ's sakes.
Yeah.
But yeah, the other thing was the music in this, because there is this good blend of music. And I know, you know, George talked a little bit about it in the interview, but I mean, you have everything from the Beach Boys to, you know, punk and ska to, you know, Dick Dale. You really kind of encompass this, almost like a 50s beach party, like Gidget meets like this punk rock movie. So whose decision was a lot of the songs? Because even like Oingo Boingo with, you know, Elfman in that, just this kind of a wide array. Can you talk a little bit about how that all came about and happened?
Yeah, well, Michael Arciaga was the music coordinator. And he made a deal with Capitol, and we had a soundtrack arrangement with Capitol. So, you know, the catalog was open to us. And I mean, I love 80s music, and I always loved surf music. And so, you know, the original idea of this thing, my pitch was Frankie and Annette Go to Hell. That's, you know, you just take a beach party movie and you make an 80s punk version of that, or, you know, just transpose that genre. And the music reflects that, because, you know, it's such, you know, the 80s movies in general, especially the independent films, all have, you know, really distinctive sound. And I think this one does as well. And, you know, I'm sorry we didn't get to do the soundtrack. And, you know, George has talked about that we still have the rights. And so, you know, depending on how this the DVD goes, you know, if there's a market for it, I think there's a good chance that we could do it.
Now here's, probably the most memorable sequence in the movie, for sure.
Yeah.
Is this eating contest.
Well, you know, I remember, so after the movie came out, I'm back to trying to make a living as a writer, and I had a pitch meeting with a very, very well-known Hollywood producer with a long career, and the guy also, it turns out, was a surfer. And so I get into his office, and he asked me about Surf 2, And but before I can say much, he says, by the way, I actually went to, I paid good money and I went to see the film in Westwood. And I made the mistake of asking him what he thought. And he goes, I hated it. And I mean, he was, he just like, what? He wanted me to give him his money back on the spot. And he goes like, what were you thinking? And he said, you know, I said, well, you didn't like anything? He goes, well, what did you like? I said, well, you know, I thought, didn't you like the gross out contest? I knew the pitch was, whatever I was there to pitch him was not going to go particularly well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, there is a lot of, you know, honestly, this movie probably aged better through time. You know, it definitely has its audience then, but it, you know, people may not have been ready for this. That's just how it is.
I absolutely agree with you. You know, I wouldn't say that unprompted, but I totally agree with you. You look at it at the time, and you know, this was kind of a thing with people who I were, you know, I mean, who I was in the business with, who I saw on a regular basis, who I did business with, and they all thought that there was something wrong with me, you know, for having done this movie. And you look at it now, and it just seems like a really whacked out 80s movie, as opposed to, you know, maybe this guy needs medication.
No, I mean, we have it all through the time, all through the history of cinema. Sometimes movies are 5-10 years too early and people just aren't ready for it.
Yeah.
You know? It's almost like that scene in Back to the Future when Marty plays that solo and he says, don't worry, your kids will love it. You know? It's just, right. It's just something like that, you know?
Yeah,
exactly. Maybe you should have said that to the audience members. See, that's, don't worry, your kids will love it.
Right. Yeah, it's true. I mean, you know, there were many awkward moments in meetings where, you know, I not knowing what to expect, where I would go in for, because I wrote mostly dramas and thrillers, and. See, now all of this got lost. Eddie, you know, going, I mean, this is hysterical. Eddie doing...
Oh, Eddie Danson, yeah.
Yeah. but people, you know, really thought there was something wrong with me because of this movie. It was like, well, you know, why would he do this, you know? If you're going to make a movie, why would you make this?
Yeah.
You know? Had to explain. Well, I didn't explain, but and here we go. Here's Johnny Ray. This was fabulous. I mean, Tom, literally at the end of this, you know, he throws himself off the stage into the sand. mean, this is total commitment.
Yeah, it's just, you know, like I said, the pacing is the biggest, is the, like, I guess pacing is the biggest attractor for me in the film, and it's one of those things where, you know, at this point in time, I don't know if I can go back and watch the theatrical anymore.
Yeah. No, I'm with you.
It's just one of those things, and I know people love the theatrical, and I'm not going to shit on that at all. You know, it still has its purpose, but it's one of those things where you know experience the same thing as watching a director's cut of any movie, you know, and you could watch, you know, it has additional gore or some sequences that are different. I mean, Blade Runner, for Christ's sakes, you know, you have those films like that, and it just changes, and there is something. You know, I don't think the audience would have changed their minds or these people that thought you were crazy. But probably there is right. there is just a little bit more of charm in this movie, your version, I mean.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I found, you know, when I watched it for the first time, when you guys sent me the, file, and I got to see it for the first time in 40 years, I actually was aside from the fact that I was struck by how different they were tonally. And
yeah, tonally.
You actually almost, so there's, this is definitely goofier and definitely sweeter, but you also almost feel sorry for Linda's character. I mean, there's just a kind of a cumulative effect. And, you know, I wasn't aware of it at the time. I mean, I was just trying to protect what I could of the movie, but how big a difference just chopping a movie up, restructuring it, taking stuff out. I mean, you think, oh, well, it's you know, a couple of minutes here, it's a couple of minutes there. What difference does it make? It makes a huge, huge difference. And, you know, I can only imagine what somebody who made a serious movie would, you know, have to go through when a studio takes over, brings in another director or recuts it. And I mean, you know, you just... It's a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, it happens all the time, and
yeah, it does.
It seems that a lot of people don't ever learn their lesson. Mm-hmm. Producers and whatnot. It still happens today, and it's just, I mean, we're still dealing with that right now with online and people having alternate cuts, and I mean, always movies, every movie is going to have a different cut, but you know, as far as having this original vision. You know, producers need to stick to producing and get the fuck out of the get out of the editing bay and stuff like that, because that's the reason why we have directors and editors, you know.
Yeah, but it doesn't start there. I mean, you know, look, I spent the majority of my career as a writer and a good bit of it as a script doctor, and you know, so you're used to the fact that a film is not just collaborative, but intrusive. There's a lot of stuff that you cannot avoid having to basically bend over and take it, and you just hope that enough survives that, you know, it'll kind of represent or come close to representing what you originally had in mind. Because, you know, the writer, I mean, it's much easier to cut a script than it is to cut a movie. And
yeah,
much
absolutely.
Cheaper, and so, which is why, as a writer, you kind of get used to being disabused and basically viewed as you know, I guess it was Jack Warner who called writers schmucks with typewriters, and you know, I've been on movies where I was like the 11th and the 13th writer on the same movie.
so
there's nothing new to it. It's just a, you know, it's the way movies are made. There's a lot of people involved and a lot of fingers in the pie.
This is Peter Isaacson's shining moment in this movie too.
This was day one. We shot this the very first day, and I remember sitting down at under the camera in the corner, because it's a very confined space, and just watching Peter do his thing.
So this is the first thing you shot, you're saying?
Yeah. Yeah, and absolutely everybody captured. It's not like you look at this and you go, wow, this kind of sticks out. It just fits right in. I mean, everybody got right into the spirit of it right away, and we were off and running from there.
No, I mean, that helps, especially with the actors and whoever's there. They kind of get an idea of, you know, I mean, obviously they already know, but this, the vibe for the movie. For sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't imagine what Linda was probably thinking around this time, because she's so she's so quiet and proper.
She was into it. She definitely, you know, gave it everything she had, and you know, there was never any reluctance or she was just game, as was everyone else.
And tell us a little about George, because George, you know, is definitely someone that it seems from, you know, speaking with George and seeing his interviews, someone that you definitely wanted on your side, but just seemed like a very good counterpart for you for this. Is that true? And how did that relationship work?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and George and I have been friends for 40 years. I mean, you know, I speak to him pretty regularly. So he and Ron, his partner at the time, were great. I mean, they gave me all the support they could. You know, they tried to run interference. There was only so much they could do in the end when it came down to the money guys taking over and wanting to make changes. But you know, they were always there for me, and I had their confidence from the beginning. And like I said, I remain friends with George. I mean, he's a real character. I don't know. I know you did an interview with him. I don't know whether you got to see, you know, who he is behind the scenes, but George is a very funny guy.
Yeah, no, he was very quiet and kind of reserved in the interview, but I definitely take your word for it, because honestly, for someone to be a part of this, they kind of have to be.
Yeah.
You know, you definitely have to, yeah, I mean, you have to have the right pieces in a movie like this, or it will not work. You know, you have to have people that understand what you're doing and what you're trying to accomplish. Even if you don't really know the end result, what you're going to end up with, yeah. Which, you know, part of that's part of filmmaking in general. The collaboration and camaraderie behind something like this, it has to work.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you really do have just a bunch of stupid shit in a movie.
Right.
Yeah.
So this was all lost. This whole scene with Eddie. And I remember, you know, he just goes so completely crazy here, his hat's falling off. I remember sitting in when you know, Jackie and I were cutting the movie and you know, just laughing. She said, "We have to leave this in. It's just he's so funny." And he is. I mean, Eddie is, you know, just a hysterical guy.
Yeah, no, all of that isn't in the movie, because immediately after that, they go to the couch, and right here,
yeah,
where this scene is, they just start, you know, sitting around and drinking, and just the more zany shit starts to happen. But
yeah.
So Linda really got to play this other kind of character before she played anything else, which is interesting, because I imagine this is still a continuation after the first day.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah, we did everything in this little cabin, and I think it was a beachside cabin up somewhere in Malibu. I don't remember where. But yeah, we did. These were the first couple of days of shooting.
Yeah, so this is kind of interesting for Linda being, you know, she kind of becomes, you know, in a sense, more of a wild thing, and then kind of more reserved. But yeah.
Well, you know, she tells her story. I mean, she basically, this is why I could never understand why people couldn't, if there was ever any doubt. I mean, basically, Linda tells you everything you need to know. She tells you who Menlo
is. Oh, yeah, we have the info dump right here.
Yeah.
You know, and all the as sort of a quick exposition and info dump. And it's just, but I mean, honestly, it might be due to the, I don't know, pacing and, you know, the editing and this theatrical, I don't know. Maybe people weren't really expecting something. Who knows?
So, I remember Peter just loved making this drive. He was really into this, driving that Cadillac down.
What's going on, Chief? I thought the beach was supposed to be closed.
Take a hike, dig around the bit.
I guess this is, where's this statue? Is that Hermosa? Or...
too busy making
I don't know. Are you familiar with the beach town?
Absolutely, no. No, yeah. Not at all.
Yeah, I think it's Hermosa Beach.
Yeah, because this is a little different too, because I believe after they leave, it goes to all the older characters. You know, with Ruth, they're at the restaurant.
Yeah.
Talking. So that's this is kind of set up a little bit different as far as the edit's concerned. Yeah, just another little thing. Did you, with kind of the reshoots, like for the second unit stuff, did they kind of kick you out of the editing bay after that?
No.
Like, were you part of the kind of the restructuring of this?
Unfortunately, yeah. I mean, I tried to prevent, total chaos and destruction. And I sat through the recut with Walt McConnery, and I was there for the mix and, fought against some of the stuff that, I think I was successful with a couple of things, but not with most. A good bit of the stuff that was stuffed in there, the TNA stuff, that was all just shot second unit, and I didn't have anything to do with that. But the stuff with Fred and Jim, I was there. I just tried to keep it somehow so that it would integrate. But, the mismatch is the stuff that, just kind of yanks you out of the movie right away. It just, Tom Ackerman, who is is a wonderfully talented DP and, has had a tremendously successful career, and he did his best to match. But, especially stuff around water and beach stuff and, the sky changes. Throughout the day and from season to season, and it's just impossible to get the stuff to match, and I thought most of it is kind of jarring, not to mention the subject matter. But
I think people will probably recognize that once they see this, that there is, because if we don't know, we're used to what we see and we don't maybe think too much of it. And not every time there's a director's cut that's better. Sometimes, that does change to where, the producers get involved and recut it. And, structurally it is better, but I think that is more rare than anything. But,
yeah. It's often the reverse of this. I mean, sometimes it's what they, the film they delivered, but very often it's the film they wanted to deliver. And then after the fact, they go back and put this stuff in that was cut and didn't time out for, there's always that push to get multiple screenings per night. And, and the director wants a 2.5 hour version. But this is quite the opposite. This was the movie. because we wouldn't have this with the credits and soundtrack and, everything, a fully mixed version of it had this not been the movie. So it's very rare that they'll go back, recut completely. So mix a movie and it's in the can, and then go back and tear it apart and add and subtract and then remix again. So it's a little unusual.
This is definitely something that I think we've established that a few times in this commentary already. This is I think butchered is a big word, but it's definitely cut up quite a bit and rearranged.
Yeah,
it's really not the same thing. And honestly, I discovered this recently. This isn't something that I even knew about until we had that conversation. And when you told me, I was kind of shocked. And also, like, you know, at first it was like, well, that might be cool to include, but then you kind of reiterated and stressed that it is different. And when I saw it, I was like, holy shit, you know, this is a big difference. You know, it's not a couple, like, three added scenes or stuff that's taken out. It's structurally, it is completely different.
Yeah.
You know, because I'm sure if you paired this movie side by side, none of it would match up. You would be so off if you played them side by side.
That's
where you would probably be able to tell the biggest part.
So, Brad, tell me again, where did you guys find... Because as far as I knew, there was only one 35mm print that was struck off the negative of this version. And where did you guys find it?
So it was a mixture of things. I think Joe found it, but we were searching multiple prints that AGFA had that, you know, that was all picked up by the Kinsey Institute, that Zach Carlson actually picked up around that time. I believe Joe found it, and I'm drawing a blank of where he said he did. But yeah, because I was having AGFA look at their prints, and I just kind of gave them hints of to where, you know, this and this and this will be different. I was like, just watch the first, you know, 2 minutes and you can tell, because there's going to be stock footage rather than a I basically said, if the scrawl is on it, then it's the theatrical. If the scrawl isn't there, then that's the cut we're looking for. And yeah, and I believe Joe found it with basically just looking at the running time on it, and that's how it all came about. Because then I was told to stop, and then we knew that we had it.
And was this the only print, or were there multiple prints of this version?
As far as I know, this is the only one.
Yeah, because that's my recollection, that there was only one, and I assumed it just went bye-bye.
So, and it very well could have.
Yeah, that's for sure.
You know, it's, you know, everything that we deal with in this industry is very fragile, and people throw away stuff all the time, because in all fairness, even though I don't agree with this, is that some people throw things away just because at that time there wasn't DVD or Blu-ray, or anybody knew that this stuff could be rescanned and, you know, remastered and look better.
Sure.
So a lot of times in this industry, stuff is just thrown away. We come across it all the time. You even have the filmmakers say, oh yeah, I threw that away. It was in my garage. It was just taking up too much space. And it's like, well, now we can't ever re-release this movie and make it look like it's supposed to, you know, because of that. But, you know, I'm very happy that we were able to find it for you on your behalf. And it's just kind of nice to have something for the fans, something new. That's always enticing. But yeah, I think we put together a really nice package with this movie, and I'm very, very, very proud of it.
Yeah, that's great.
So, and then of course, you know, after all these years, you get to have your moment where finally, you know, your version and vision is seen. I don't know how great that is after all these years. And, you know, I know that you're, you know, obviously unhappy with the result in the beginning, but,
it's a revelation. George and I were just talking about this earlier today, literally, because he and his wife watched it for the first time in all these years the other night. And, you know, you have the same reactions, like, oh, wow, yeah, this was the movie we made. And, you know, it is what it is, but, you know, at the time and still, it's to get a movie made is a really, there have to be so many things that come together to get a movie made. And then, you know, to have it come out somewhat resembling what you had hoped to accomplish, and then have that be destroyed, or at least, you know, really disfigured, you know, that was heartbreaking. So, and there's this, you know, there's still a lot of people who would look at this and say, you know, are you kidding? You know?
Oh, no, absolutely. Yeah, no, I know that there's going to be various responses and very interesting responses to this from, you know, from our fans and, you know, that support our label and people that have never heard or seen this movie. It's going to be a very, very mixed reaction, but, you know, that's how these movies survive and live.
Yeah.
Because if no one's talking about them, they just disappear.
Yeah. Are you guys, do you have any screenings, lined up, or
is... Well, I mean, that's something that AGFA kind of handles for us with theatrical. Uh-huh. But, you know, after this is discovered, maybe this is going to be the new norm for your midnight screenings for this movie, because this movie's had midnight screenings a lot, and this could be like the new thing.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing planned for the moment, but I mean, I definitely see this happening for sure.
Mm-hmm. Great.
So I mean, with everything, with of course the, you know, coronavirus and everything, that definitely messed up some things that, you know, obviously we would probably want to do, or, you know, have, you know, theatrical screenings and different things of for films. But eventually everything will get back to normal here.
Well, you know, the timing could be great, because things are going to be opening up, and there's probably not a whole lot of product out there.
Yeah, no, festivals are running short of things, so that's... you know, and obviously there's a hole on movies being made for the past few months. So
sure.
There is going to, and eventually here in probably the next 6 months to a year, there's going to be a shortage because nothing was made around that time. So next year should be interesting for film. And I think a lot more little independent movies will be popping up.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, they had... You know, they obviously don't have crews of 500. You know, some very small crews, a lot safer for sure. But so, what did Eric Stoltz? Did you ever talk to Eric Stoltz about this movie after his? You know, he had major success in Hollywood, and did you ever talk to him about this? Because we tried reaching him, we never got a hold of him. But I was just curious of what someone like of that stature really, you know, that didn't really do a whole lot of comedy, I guess, in the sense. I mean, he did his share, but nothing like this.
Right. We had a great relationship doing the movie, and I think for like a year after we kind of stayed in touch, and but. I know he and Peter kind of stayed in touch for a long time. I haven't talked to Eric in quite a number of years. And I really never asked him anything specifically about the movie, other than he enjoyed doing it. We had a great relationship on the set. You know, we stayed in touch for a while. And you know how movie relationships go. You know, you're all thrown in together,
yeah.
And everybody's... your best friends, and then you never see each other again. So it's, you know, I've certainly I've followed his career. I mean, to me it was pretty clear the guy was going to be very successful. So there, you know, that was not a surprise.
I know Ruth Buzzy is a big fan of this too.
Uh-huh. Did you do an interview with Ruth?
No, she's retired from everything.
Uh-huh.
For the most part, I mean, she's still around, and she's doing well, but yeah, she's just kind of out, kind of the same thing with Terry Kaiser.
Yeah.
You know, both really nice things to say, but just kind of over everything in
right.
a way.
Right.
In a good way, not in a negative way, just in a good way, just kind of, you know, we're done.
Mm-hmm.
We've done our stuff, and I completely agree. I mean, with careers for both of them like that, you know, it's very apparent that, you know, time to call it quits.
Right.
But yeah, no, we reached out to pretty much everybody.
Mm-hmm.
No, we reached out to numerous. I was incredibly thankful to have Eddie part of this because at the time, he as his brother said, he shouldn't be here right now because of his health and everything of sorts. He had a very, very bad time for almost 9 months.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
And when we had this movie, I just said, this is I really want to do this, but it's not going to be the same if we don't have Eddie.
Right.
And we had a release date for the film, and we knew what we were going to do. I just didn't know when it was appropriate to ask his brother I didn't want to be imposing. I didn't want to be rude. Like, of course, Eddie's health is way more important than a Blu-ray feature.
Right.
You know, an extra. You know, I didn't want to seem like I was insensitive. So I refrained from, reaching out. And I was actually talking to Peter. And, he said, did you talk to Eddie? And I said, no. I was like, I'm afraid to reach out because I don't want to seem insensitive. I know he's having, a tough time. And then I think 2 weeks after I spoke to Peter, I get a text from Peter Isaacson saying, hey, you should contact Eddie. It looks like he's doing a little bit better. And he was like almost right out of the hospital.
Wow.
And I talked to his brother, and he said, let's try to make something work. And it really perked Eddie up,
Oh, that's great.
He was, he was only out of the hospital for a very short time, and he was thrilled to do it, and we made it work, and he was happy. I was over the moon about it. Like I said, because obviously having everybody is great. Having you, Peter, George, all of that worked out really well. But it just would have been really weird if we didn't
without
have
Eddie. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I totally agree, and that I'm really pleased to hear that. That's great. So we had these guys in the water in Paradise Cove, and the next day they spotted a 15-foot great white.
Ooh.
Right there. It was in the papers. The guys, people were a little concerned.
Yeah, I think that's what Linda mentioned in her interview, and then some other people just jumped in the water, but she was apprehensive about anything on the beach or something like that. I can't remember really what she said, but she did mention that.
Yeah. That was great. We really got lucky that Eddie didn't get swamped there. He managed to get on the beach in one piece. And I think we had to make a dupe of his. He brought us his Jerry Lewis picture, and we had to make several, dupes of it so that we wouldn't ruin his original.
So with making something like this, from a personal perspective, obviously you did this, you're proud of what you did. How does this film, I guess, with personally, because it's the only film you've directed, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
So basically your feelings towards the film from then, and let's just say 20 years ago to now, how the evolution of love to this movie, how just your personal experience with this film. Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
I have to go back to the fact that the film was a fluke. The whole thing was just, I wrote it. after an accident, completely doped up on painkillers, and wrote it in a weekend. And the fact that anything came of it at all, you know, was just beyond a fluke. And, you know, so when I got the opportunity to direct, of course I wasn't going to say no. And I had a great time doing it. You know, the guys at CAA thought I was, you know, their new teen exploitation director. I got a big push from that. But then when the movie fizzled and, you know, that all went away real fast. But, you know, I wrote over the years dozens, literally dozens of original screenplays. And I just assumed that, you know, there would come another opportunity. And for one reason or another, it just never did. And, you know, this is just the, you know, the only original that actually got made. Everything else was either an assignment, a rewrite, you know, an adaptation. I had lots and lots of things come really, really close. And I'll tell you real quickly, sort of the probably the most telling experience. And that was, I had written a script called The Boat, which was basically Rosemary's Baby in a harbor, and had a lot of activity on it. And Sylvester Stallone was going to buy it and do it as his first of 10 films for Curalco. And we had a deal done. It was Friday night, and we got a call from his attorney, Jake Bloom, who we had made the deal with. And he asked us if we were supposed to sign on Friday afternoon. He asked if they could just have the weekend because the guys at CAA wanted to talk to Stallone, and they were sort of trying to plot out his future. And what they did over that weekend was they talked him out of this 10-picture deal, mine being the first, and they talked him into Rhinestone. Just a horrendous, horrendous motion picture that just about derailed, you know, half a dozen careers. But it began, it was the first CAA package. And it began the great era of packaging, wherein the agencies basically became the studios, and the studios became the banks. And, you know, the client's interest took second place to the agency's dictates. And that therein, I think, you know, there are so many of those stories that I could tell you, but that one sort of epitomizes, you know, how difficult it is, how close you can get, and, you know, how much in the hands of fate all of this stuff is. And so I'll just leave it at that.
No, that's a shame, because I always tell people, if you want to watch a script gone wrong or hear a script gone wrong, watch Rhinestone.
There it is.
Because there's a line in Rhinestone that Stallone is doing stand-up, and he says, you know when Barnett's been over to your house because the toilet seat's up and the cat's pregnant. and I, you know, I laugh at that. But I'm like, who in the hell wrote that?
Right.
Like, where does that actually come from?
Right.
But, yeah, no, that's a shame. I'm sorry to hear that. But, watch Surf 2 instead of Rhinestone. But Rhinestone is great in its own way. But, yeah, definitely a weird... That's an odd thing from going to a serious film or anything, really, and Rhinestone being the first. That seems like that should be the last, or
well, it wasn't. It wasn't even the first. They shit canned the entire Curalco 10-picture deal. He was going to do it under, I think it was called White Eagle, was his company, and you know they gave him this enormous budget to do 10 pictures, and he had his choice. He could produce. and then had his choice of starring, directing, you know, basically carte blanche, whatever he wanted to do. And The Boat was going to be his first one. And that entire deal went away, all 10 pictures. And it's so that CAA could manipulate their clients into Rhinestone.